Hello and welcome back. My name's James Marley. I'm a co-founder of Livewire Markets and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. The Rules of Investing gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists and industry experts, and it's brought to you by Livewire Markets. My guest today is Warren Robertson, who's one of the pioneers of global listed infrastructure investing in Australia and is a portfolio manager and analyst for Lazard Asset Management's Global Listed Infrastructure Fund. Now, Warren is a repeat guest on The Rules of Investing and was last on in June 2022. That's a time when inflation was raging, interest rates were about to take off, and in that interview, Warren explained why investing in infrastructure could be one of the best ways to protect against inflation. So with rates today seemingly at the peak, for now at least, and inflation cooling, we're going to check in with Warren to see how the asset class has performed. We'll also chat about the shrinking universe of infrastructure stocks on the ASX and some of the ideas Warren is finding today. If you're an Apple Podcast or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a Livewire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of the wire to be notified when new episodes are available. If you're not a Livewire subscriber yet, we'd love to have you on board. Just head on over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free, easy to register, and you'll get access to insights from the leading investment minds in the country. With that, let's get on with the show. Warren, great to have you back on The Rules of Investing.
Always good to be here, James. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, the last time we spoke was in June 2022. The official interest rate in Australia was 0.85%. Seems like an age ago. And inflation, as I mentioned, was running rampant. Since then, there have been 11 interest rate hikes and inflation now appears to be under control. In that chat, you explain why infrastructure assets can be the best inflation protection you can get. So my question to you is, did the asset class do the job for investors?
Look, on the whole, it probably has. I think we need to be cautious around throwing that blanket inflation protection attribute across all infrastructure. There are certain infrastructure assets that certainly have those attributes and some that don't. And the nuances around how that inflation adjustment goes through either the regulatory approval process or through the contracted revenue streams or tolls that or landing charges that airports have, those nuances are just important to understand. So what we've seen is where it's explicitly inflation protected, and that happens in Australia, it happens in the UK, it happens in Europe. They've done incredibly well. And what we've seen where it's implicitly inflation protected, and that is that the returns are nominal in nature and the regulator has to make an assumption about what inflation will be, they've done okay, but not quite as well. And that I would categorise as US utilities.
What are some examples of those explicit inflation protections?
Yeah, so in Australia, you're talking about companies like Transurban that have tolls that increase at an explicit rate relative to inflation. You have the same assets and inflation protected attributes in French toll roads, and also probably the best example we've seen in recent times is in the United Kingdom, where you've had UK Water Stocks and National Grid, which owns the monopoly electricity and transmission grids. Their returns have been linked to the increases in RPI, and they are contractually regulated to go up with that number on the 1st of April. And so they're the ones that have done particularly well, whereas the US ones have struggled.
So in the UK, water is costing households an inflation-adjusted amount compared to what it was 12 months ago.
Exactly right. What we like about UK water in particular is that you have that inflation-protected attribute. You've got monopoly assets that have incredibly stable demand profiles. But most importantly, in this cost of living crisis that we're seeing across the globe, in the UK, it's less than 1% of people's household budgets. So we're not seeing the sticker shock from large inflation pass-throughs causing issues for the household budget for water companies in the United Kingdom because it's such a small portion of household budgets.
Let's just step back a little bit and kind of set the scene for where we are today. If interest rates have peaked and revenues have stayed ahead of inflation, does this provide a good setup for infrastructure now?
I think it does, yeah. I mean, what you've seen is a period where you've had that recovery phase, particularly for the patronage risk assets as they've come out of COVID. I mean, infrastructure is, when you think of it at its heart, it's how we go about our daily lives. It is the backbone of a modern society. Now, when you break that backbone, if you use that analogy, and you say to people, actually, you have to be locked down in your homes, that's when that nexus broke down. It was a 1-in-100-year event. And what we're seeing is a recovery from that for the patronage risk assets. And what I'm talking about there is railways, I'm talking about toll roads, I'm talking about airports. Utilities didn't have that large adjustment in terms of demand profile because essentially we stayed at home, we still turned the lights on, we still brushed our teeth, we still turned the gas on to cook. But the patronage risk assets are recovering, and I think they're set up for what looks like decent growth prospects over the next 12 to 18 months. But again, as with all assets today, you need to be selective. There are certain assets that we think have run ahead of where fair value are, others where they're trading below where their fair value is, and it's those ones that you need to be selective about and picking in your portfolio, and they're the ones you want to own.
I often think about infrastructure as not dissimilar to long duration bonds. You know, you've got these long cash flows and they were quite rate sensitive. How much of an impact does the rates outlook have on your view on infrastructure more broadly? If rates start falling, is that a tailwind for the asset class?
As far as the market is concerned, I suspect that is a tailwind for it. As far as we're concerned and the way we value the assets, there is no impact. We've used long-term, consistent bond yield assumptions for every country across the globe for nearly 20 years. So I can remember being on podcasts and in conferences where 3 or 4 years ago I talk about the fact that we thought the long bond for the US should be around 5%. And, you know, I'd sort of mumble that under my beard. Now I sort of speak about it with a lot more authority and confidence because I think more people in the room would consider that to be an appropriate bond yield. We've always considered that to be an appropriate bond yield for the US, 6% for Australia, 4.25% for Europe. So for us, the valuations don't change, but for the market, it probably will create a tailwind. And that's what creates the buying opportunities or selling opportunities for long-term investors that have that consistency evaluation approach and don't mark to market when bond yields move. You make an interesting point about long duration assets and bond proxies. And in fact, that's the light bulb moment that a lot of investors had in the last 12 to 18 months about the nuanced difference between US utilities and utilities in Europe and the United Kingdom. The US utilities are more analogous to a nominal bond, whereas utilities in the UK and in Europe are inflation-linked bonds. And that's what I mean by that explicit inflation protection versus implicit. And that's where you've seen that difference become quite stark in terms of the relative performance that the North American utilities have generated over the last 12 months and what the European and UK utilities have.
Let's dig into that a little further, because when we speak in June 2022, and for those people listening to the podcast, I'll put a link to that interview in the notes, but you outlined what you thought was quite a simple thesis explaining why you thought those US utilities were looking expensive and were actually quite vulnerable. Could you go into a bit more detail on what the experience has been since then?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about how US utilities are regulated, and you know, I can see everyone sort of yawning and turning off here, but it is an important thing to consider when you invest in this asset class. Before I start in answering the question, the upshot of infrastructure is that they are simple assets. They're pretty easy for most people to understand. But then there are very important details that you've got to get on top of to make the selective decisions that will be critically important at certain points in transitioning in different financial markets. So this example is really quite important. So for US utilities, they're regulated with a nominal return on equity. So that is that a regulator in the 50 states of the US and federal regulator is FERC, so 51 regulators in total, will sit there and make a judgment call about what they think is the right return on equity that a US utility should receive on its historical cost asset base. So it's just like your old financial accounts and what you did in Accounting 101, return on equity on shareholders' funds. So that is historical cost, and it requires an approach which says my nominal return, I have to consider what is the real return on equity plus a return for inflation. Now, they don't think about it in that construct, but that's what they have to do. And what we'd seen over the last 10, 15, 20 plus years is as interest rates had fallen, almost continually going down, and ROEs had drifted lower, the gap between those two lines had increased to a point where the US investor, who was, as you go back to your earlier question, James, marking to market using spot bond yields and what the regulator said current return on equities were prepared to pay the highest multiples ever seen for US utilities, because they had bond yields at 3% and return on equities at 10%. Now, what's happened subsequently is return on equities have stayed relatively the same, but the bond yield has started to rise back up to where we've seen it today, 4% going towards 5%. And we think in a world where a 5% bond yield, which is what we use for the US, is appropriate, then a return on equity of 10, 10.5% is appropriate. So a gap of about 5.5%, not a gap of 7 to 8%. And that's why we always felt that a more appropriate PE multiple is in the vicinity of 13, 14 times, not 20 times plus. And that was the very simple argument that we had going back 12, 18 months ago. Now, what's happened is you've seen the PEs come back to around that 14 times. You've seen bond yields rise. So the market's adjusted for that. The difference, what they haven't adjusted for, is the balance sheet. And what we've seen used in the world when interest rates were low and debt was cheap is exotic structures so that regulated utilities didn't have to use a simple mix of 50% long-term bonds and 50% equity. What they did was they said, I'll take my 50% equity and I'll be clever and I'll put redeemable preference shares, convertible preference notes, hybrid debt securities, or even holdco debt, anything but straight old plain equity because I was getting a turbocharged impact on my EPS and the market loved that when interest rates were low. Now, interest rates have gone back to more normal levels. All of a sudden, getting those hybrids away, convertible preference notes away at attractive rates is much more difficult. And that's the second phase of what we think will be a prolonged downturn for US utilities. So the ones we're looking at today are ones where their holdco, hybrid, convertible note, all the funky structures that they had are limited and not being used extensively. So they're the ones that we're more attracted to, but we're still cautious on that geographical sector as a whole, and we remain so.
You've talked there about balance sheets and gearing. It was actually going to be one of my next questions, and we've been come off the back of that aggressive interest rate hiking cycle. Sounds like a lot of these companies are needing it, and utilities are needing to refinance. Is there evidence out there that there's balance sheet stress or over-gearing? We've seen a little bit of that take place in the property sector. Are you seeing that in infrastructure as well?
In pockets, yes. So where companies have been a little too clever and tried to use too aggressive a gearing structure, they're starting to come undone. The canary in the coal mine for us is the holdco debt for US utilities. So this is typically, instead of being held as a bond across a regulated utility asset, it's the owner of that asset is the equity owner of themselves, and they're raising debt, more, a bit like a margin loan, if you think about it in that respect. Those bonds or bank debt tend to be shorter in tenor, and they're starting to roll now, and you're seeing appreciable increases in rates there. So they're going from when rates were very low in the 3% sort of range, now in the 7s. But across the majority of the assets that we look at, there's still no major issues in terms of banks not wanting to lend to them, major changes in margins above risk-free rates. It's the same scenario that played out back in 2008-09 in the global financial crisis. These are the one asset in the globe, infrastructure, that bankers will want to lend to because of, unless you get a pandemic or people get locked down, they're incredibly stable demand profiles. They're great credit risks. And so, you know, you're less likely to see issues come forward for those types of assets as long as they're appropriately leveraged. You can over-leverage any asset and create a problem, as has been historically the case here in Australia. And there's, you know, many examples we can talk to.
Well, bankers like to lend to utilities, and super funds and private equity firms like to buy them and take them private. Are you expecting that trend to continue? Because we do have a shrinking market here in Australia. I think I was able to count 14 odd infrastructure and utility companies with a market cap over $1 billion. It's not a huge universe now.
No. And of those 14, if I can pick the ones you've chosen, about four of them are what we refer to as preferred infrastructure. And so they're the ones that are monopoly-like with inflation-protected revenue streams or returns, manageable debt profiles, and sort of, you know, that typical what you would think of as an infrastructure asset. The vast majority that are left are actually operating competitive markets. So they're merchant power generators that sort of are leveraged commodity price plays in many ways, the AGLs, the Origins, the Meridian Energies of the world. So the ones that we look at are the Transurbans, the Auckland Airports, and the Atlas Alterias. Now, interestingly enough, 20 years ago, I was a dedicated Australia and New Zealand infrastructure analyst. Now, if I continued to be that today, I'd have four stocks and I wouldn't have a job. So I've had to look to, you know, keep my amount of research that I do for the team overseas. And so you're right, we are seeing private equity, sovereign wealth funds, not only in Australia, but globally take over opportunities that we look at. I mean, the way I like to categorize it for people is since the inception of our strategy almost 20 years ago, we've only ever considered for investment in our investable universe 160 investment opportunities. Of those, 25 have been taken out by either acquisitions of other listed companies buying them or private equity funds buying them or sovereign wealth funds buying them. Now, that's an incredibly high hit rate. So the characteristics that we desire are exactly the ones that those sovereign wealth funds, private equity funds, and other listed companies want, because they are those, if I use the great throwaway line, they're inflation-linked bonds with rising coupons. That's essentially what we want to invest in, and we're not the only ones.
And do you expect that trend to continue? Is there a point where there'll be a stable base, or is it just these assets keep getting picked off bit by bit?
I think they will continue to be picked off in the short to medium term. When you take aside the private equity guys or the sovereign wealth funds and sort of talk to them, and I've done this over many years, they sit there and say, in the long run, they acknowledge that the lowest cost of funding, as opposed to the cost of capital, the lowest cost of funding for these assets is the listed market. There's nothing clever that they're doing in terms of changing the business operations for preferred infrastructure assets, the one that we like. And, you know, if you think about operational risk, it's asymmetrical for the assets we look at. There isn't a lot of value you can add, but you can destroy a whole bunch of value if you don't manage the regulatory process or the government situation well. So we're looking for those types of assets, the bond-like operating risk assets, and as are sovereign wealth funds and private equity funds. But they acknowledge that in the long run, they should be on the listed market because we've got the lower cost of equity financing. Now, in the short term, that's not the case because they have asset allocations they have which are unmet. They have dry powder, which last estimate I've seen is $200 billion. Now, you throw a bit of debt on top of that, you're talking $400 billion of potential buying power. And that's just the private equity guys. That doesn't look at the sovereign wealth funds of the world that are under allocated to this asset class. So I think in the short to medium term, it is going to be commonplace. You are going to see lots of takeovers occur. And you know that's something that creates opportunities for us as long-term investors. We're happy to sell if the takeout premium is the right price for us, but it also creates, it's a double-edged sword. There's less opportunities then for us moving forward.
And what about on the flip side in terms of new infrastructure or utility assets? There's a lot of interest in, you know, new power generation, renewable power generation, investment in grid. Do you expect, I'm sure it won't happen at the rate that they get taken off because they're hard to create, but are you seeing new opportunities associated with some of these thematics to provide you new infrastructure opportunities?
Look, absolutely. So part of the thesis around companies like National Grid, a lot of the North American utilities that we spoke about, is the requirement to build out their asset bases. And in the case of the US utilities who are integrated, and that is that they do generation, transmission, so the big poles and wires, distribution, which is how the big poles and wires get to your home, and then they retail, so they actually charge you a bill. So they do the entire value chain. They are replacing old coal fired generators with new renewables across the United States. That's what we call rate-based growth or asset growth, and that's an attractive attribute that they have. So there's a lot of growth that's coming. Some of it's incentivized through the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States, which is clearly a benefit. There are tax incentives also. So all of these things are lining up to create a good growth profile for those types of investments. The counter argument for that is the issue of what does it do for customer bills? And that's always where we come back to. It's a lot of people, without trying to get down a whole new different rabbit hole, but when people think about ESG today, they really spend 90% of their time talking about C, carbon. Okay, well, that is part of the equation. That's an important part. And that is an important part for utilities today because they are replacing carbon intensive with non-carbon intensive generation. The flip side to that is the social. What does this do in terms of customer bills, and what is a return that regulators will allow so that they can finance this asset requirement but not cause customer bill shock for the actual ratepayers themselves? And that's a balancing act that's quite an important one for us to understand. Go back to what I said earlier, comfortable with UK water because 1% of household bills. When you're in some states in the United States, it could be 7%, 8%. In Australia, we're looking at that sort of number in terms of where we're going to get to in the next decade for electricity rates as a percentage of household bills. So that's where the sticker shock starts to come in. And that's the nuance where you've got to think about ESG, not just within impact on carbon, but also the broader impact around what does this mean for society and also the household bill shock, as I said before.
Before we move into a little exercise that I've put together on us to have a look at some of those opportunities on the ASX and offshore, just broadly, where are you finding the best opportunities in your universe right now? What are you excited about?
excited about a lot of opportunities in Europe. You know, and we've been long European infrastructure for some time because of the differences in their regulatory structure for the US versus the US utilities, as I've talked about before, but also some of the toll roads that we see. And when I talk about Europe, talk about one of the stocks that is favoured for us at the moment and has been for some time, Ferrovial. It's listed in Spain. Now it's looking to do a secondary listing on the New York Stock Exchange for good reason. 80% of their assets are in the US. So even though, you know, we like Ferrovial, it's a Spanish stock, it's European, the real driver of its value is the US. So we're not negative the United States, we're just negative some assets. You've got to be selective in this asset class today. But overwhelmingly, Europe is more attractive to us than North America. Australasia's mixed within sectors. We like toll roads, recovery from COVID. We like some utilities, as I said, UK water in particular. But, you know, we've got a portfolio today that's pretty well balanced across both those sectors, US railways as well.
Well, I did go through a little exercise, tried to identify all the ASX-listed utility and infrastructure stocks. By my count, I said 14 over a billion-dollar market cap. I could be wrong. For those of you on the podcast, I'll quickly rattle off the names just to bring you into the picture. So the infrastructure stocks, we had Origin Energy, AGL, APA Group, Mercury NZ, Meridian Energy, AGL, Genesis Energy, and Contact Energy. And then under the industrials, we had Transurban, Auckland International Airport, Infratil, Atlas Arterial, Horizon, and Cube Holdings. Warren, does that sound like a relatively good close assessment of it?
Sounds like a pretty good list. Yeah.
Okay. So I thought it'd be interesting if you could pick a local infrastructure company that passes your filters. So one from that list that you actually think looks attractive on valuation grounds, despite the scarce numbers on the ground. And then I thought maybe you could pick one where you've actually gone and found better value offshore just to show the benefits of going offshore. And if for each of those companies, if you could just take us through your framework for investing, which you talked about last time as being monopolistic, having inflation-protected revenues, having high margins and reasonable leverage. So could you talk through an example of a local company where you found that more compelling value offshore?
Sure. So looking at the list that you've provided there, of those 14 names we consider for investment, only four of them. So for us, it's around those preferred characteristics that you beautifully spoke about just before: monopolistic, inflation protected, high margins, manageable debt structures. You know, we like the regulatory arrangements in Australia. They've worked well for companies over many, many years. And so one I would pick out of that list would be Transurban, the monopolistic owner of toll roads across Australia. They also have some interests in North America, but the vast majority, 90 plus percent of the value as we measure it, is in Australian toll roads. These are long-term concessioned, call that contracted assets. You as a road user have the option of choosing not to use their roads and being stuck in arterial roads for a prolonged period of time, or you can choose to pay a toll and have a time saving. So the term toll road, I think in many ways is a misnomer. They are time saving assets for people. And so it's your value of time that you will allocate to say, yes, I will pay a toll so that I have a quicker trip, but also a more predictable trip. And that is the benefit that they provide. Transurban's invested something like $36 billion along with their partners in Australia over the last, and that's the east coast of Australia, over the last couple of decades. So they're a big investor. Everyone knows who they are. And the assets are wonderful. They're long, multi-decade roads that have inflation or inflation plus toll increases. You've got congestion in their corridor, so you would expect to see good increases in traffic. And they are, as far as attributes go, a really wonderful asset. Valuation-wise, fair value around today's price. You know, we're happy owners and holders of that, but we don't have a very large position. It's probably one of the 25 names that we own. It's in the bottom five in terms of attractiveness. One that is better value for us today is stock I mentioned before, Ferrovial. So it has toll roads predominantly in North America, some in Europe, but 80% of its value is five toll roads in North America. So there is the 407, which is the biggest asset that it has. That's in Ontario, Canada. It's recovering after quite harsh lockdown, similar to what we had in Sydney/Melbourne, not quite as hard as Melbourne, a little bit harder than Sydney. So they're not quite back to where they were pre-COVID levels for traffic, but they've just increased their tolls 14% after holding them flat for the entire COVID period. And we expect to see very little elasticity, i.e. we expect to see very little shock from customers not using the road, and we don't expect to see a large decrease in traffic in the face of a 14% increase in tolls. Why? Because they sit adjacent to the busiest corridor in North America, which is Highway 401. The other assets they have are US managed lanes. This is essentially a hot lane project. And think of it this way. We don't have these in Australia, but imagine you've got a free freeway in Sydney or Melbourne, and you've got two lanes in the medium strip, which you can pay a toll on to use and travel somewhere between 50, 55, 60 miles an hour. So you can sit in the free road, and this is the case on the I-66, and do literally a peak hour less than 10 miles an hour, or you can pay a toll and travel 50 miles an hour. And they can charge whatever they want at whatever time of the day to ensure that you travel at that speed. Now, you can imagine what tolls are being charged when it is Friday morning peak hour and you are doing 10 miles an hour on the free road. So these assets...
So the pricing is dynamic.
It's basically dynamic. And they are difficult to get your head around, incredibly problematic to value, because you know when you sit there and you value it and you say, okay, let's assume wages go up a 4% per annum. That's kind of inflation plus a bit for productivity. That kind of makes sense. Let's assume tolls go up at that. These guys have been putting tolls up at 20, 30% on an annualized basis. In the last 12 months, now they're recovering from COVID. They're in Texas, three of the four roads. They're in Texas, they had less lockdowns, so they weren't nothing like, probably more like Brisbane, if you think of it in an Australian context in terms of lockdowns. Very liberal in many ways, probably even less so. So those assets have had, in the last 12 months, the underperformer did 20% increase in EBITDA. The overperformer did 100. They turned $200 million of EBITDA pre-COVID into $800 million of EBITDA US. You keep looking at the numbers, and I made a joke in my research report that I wrote to the guys the other week. I said I had to ask IR whether Bernie Madoff was actually working for them, because these numbers just don't look real.
Too good to be true.
Too good to be true. And they are, it's a stunning, they are stunning assets. They truly are. Now, every asset has its price. The share price of Freightos has done incredibly well for us. We still hold a very large position in the portfolio today, and we're still very comfortable holding that position.
The pricing sounds a bit like Australian airfares. It seems quite dynamic. You pop on and you pop back 5 minutes and it's gone up $100.
Going up $100, yeah. Except the difference here is you don't have a choice of which airline to use, although the choice is fairly limited in Australia, as you rightly point out.
Okay, so that was the example where you found similar assets, better value offshore. Can you talk me through one of those examples on the ASX that you think does pass your filters and meet your valuation criteria that attractive?
Yeah, so out of the 14, as I said, only four pass our criteria. One that we do like in terms of value other than Transurban is Atlas Arteria Roads, another toll road. This business essentially has a portfolio of roads. About half of their value, maybe a little more than half of their value, is in French toll roads. The other half of their value is in two roads in North America. They're not as attractive an asset as the ones I described about Ferrovial in terms of the dynamic pricing. They don't have that. They have contracted revenues. But the Chicago Skyway still has a fairly liberal tolling regime. They have the greater of inflation, nominal GDP per capita, or 2% per annum. So if you think about that over a 50-plus year concession, you are looking at a toll road that will have well above inflation toll growth over its life, because you're getting the greater of inflation, nominal GDP per capita, or 2%. So you've got that. The minimum is going to be 2%. And so given where inflation was in the last couple of years, you've seen quite egregious toll increases for that road as well. Now, it's not as congested a corridor. I'm not saying it's quite as good as some of the managed lanes, but it's still a very good road. Where the opportunity has come with Atlas Arteria in recent times is the French government has decided it wants to impose a tax on infrastructure owners who generate more than $120 million in revenue. One of their assets, APRR, which is their key asset, is one of the large highway networks, toll road networks in the northeast of France, the Rhine area, the Rhine route area that, of France. That toll road concession is now subject to this new tax, and the market has priced the stock down 15% because of it. Now, it takes about 5% off our value if it comes into force. The interesting thing is, if you look at Vinci and you look at Eiffage, who also own toll roads in France. In fact, Eiffage is the other owner of the toll road APRR that Atlas Arteria owns. Its share price is flat and Vinci's is up. So it's telling you the French investor looking at French listed assets is not that concerned about this tax, simply because there's a lot of question marks about whether or not they'll be able to get it passed and whether or not we'll actually be able to stick. There's a multitude of examples of where within the European Union regulation means that they're actually not able to make these punitive one-off sort of isolated taxes. We've seen examples in Italy where the Italian government tried to change the rules and the European Union stepped in. And so we think there'll be a negotiated settlement at some point. But clearly the investors in France are saying, well, the impact's going to be limited to nothing, whereas in Australia we think it's greater than what we're saying is the full impact. So that's what's creating the opportunity for that stock today, and we're excited about it.
A bit of emotion around regulatory oversight.
Yeah, and look, it can't just take it. And look, our view is we don't think it will come through, but let's assume it does. Let's put that into our valuation and let's see how it stacks up. And if it still stacks up as it does, then we're happy owning and buying it.
Very good. Well, that's the end of the main part of the interview. But as we do on all episodes of The Rules of Investing, we have some regular questions. So we might dive into those. The first one I wanted to find out is, what's the most common misunderstanding that people make when comparing infrastructure to other real assets?
Yeah, this is a really good question. People bucket a whole bunch of stuff in real assets, which has very different ways in which they have inflation-protected attributes. So if you think about infrastructure, and what I talk about here is preferred infrastructure. So this is the assets that we look at. Inflation is applied, and inflation comes through their revenues or their returns in a contracted or regulatory way. That is similar to what TIPS or inflation-linked bonds have. Now, they are unique. So the other assets that are in the real asset bucket, be they commodities, be they property, and they've got some of those attributes, but I'll talk more about that in a minute. Those types of assets are essentially commodities. I mean, the only reason commodities have an inflation linkage is that the costs of production go up in inflation, because commodity prices in the long run are set where supply meets demand. The supply curve shifts by inflation because your cost of production go up. Now, that is a indirect, if anything, an indirect nuanced link to inflation. It's not inflation in the RPI number comes out on the 1st of April. That is what the UK Water bills their customers. The tolls go up every quarter because that is what the concession deed says they will go up by, you know, inflation or a multiple thereof. This is commodity prices, supply and demand. Maybe they meet, maybe they don't. Lithium goes up, doesn't. The speculators in there, no, they're not. Gold goes up because God knows why.
There's other factors at force. Correct. That can move it around and drown out that inflation linkage.
Exactly, and it drowns out the nuanced approach. Now, even property that will have potentially, you'll see some leases will have inflation adjustments in them. You've always got the choice to say, actually, we don't want to stay on this floor or this building anymore. We're going to move somewhere else. And so then, you know, they've got to relet. They've got reletting risk. Now, yeah, a toll road has reletting risk in inverted commas, but every day you turn up and use the toll road, and you might choose not to on a certain day, or you might be holidaying. But there's, in the case of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, 220,000 other people who are using the bridge and the tunnel. So if you do your holiday, doesn't really have an impact on the whole picture. And so that nuanced difference is really important. And that's why I think it stands head and shoulders above the other alternatives within the real asset bucket. And as you say, if you're putting together or cobbling together all those types of assets, then you're not really getting, there's a lot more noise that comes through rather than inflation protection.
Is there anything when you look across the infrastructure market that you think investors are getting wrong more broadly at the moment? Do you think people placing bets in the wrong places? Is there a big misunderstanding taking place?
I mean, US utilities, again, I'll harp on the same point. You know, people are going to look at that and go, oh, okay, their PEs are now back in line with the two-decade average, which is roughly right, but they're not then considering, that's half the story. The other half the story is, of course, what does the debt in the balance sheet look like? And if you go back to the 1990s, you had 3x net debt to EBITDA was commonplace across US utes. In the 2000s, it went to 4. Today, it's 6. Now, that's not because Fitch, S&P, Standard & Poor's have all said you can go and borrow more money to build out your rate-based growth, as it's called, or the asset growth, or the energy transition from coal to solar and wind. What that is, again, I go back to the whole code debt, the nuanced hybrids, the convertible notes. That problem I think people are taking shortcuts on, and you can see the beauty of being an infrastructure specialist and having a specialist fund is we see generalists come in and out of these stocks all the time. And if they think there's a downturn coming in Australia, if the economy is going to be soft, you buy Transurban because it's more predictable. Yeah, okay, that's true. If you think interest rates are going to go up, oh, you don't buy Transurban because it's, you know, got interest rate shock sensitivity. Well, that's not true because as tolls go up in inflation. So we play off the generalist in many respects, and I used to joke about it, but probably because utilities are the most boring sector in the asset class, that's given to the junior analyst in the equity team. So, you know, you can go and look after those sort of boring stocks. That's fine. Boring's beautiful for me. Happy to spend our time getting the nuances right and being able to make those calls because they're really important today. If I look at the 85-odd investment opportunities that we have across the globe that we believe meet our preferred infrastructure characteristics, there's only about 25 that we want to own on valuation grounds. So the vast majority of our universe is expensive. That's not uncommon across broader equity markets, in my opinion. You have to be selective. You want asset managers and fund managers today to make calls. You don't want a 100-stock portfolio that's tilted towards some factor. You want asset allocators and investors who have made a call that this is an attractive stock and I want to own it because it's mispriced today and I think there's upside there. And there are few of those. And so you need to protect capital, you need to be concentrated. It sounds kind of the opposite of what you would think. You know, times are difficult. Typically what people say is you diversify. No, that's the wrong thing to do today. Today, you've got to be have strengthen your convictions and own the names that you think are attractively priced. And I think that is very important today, not just in infrastructure, but across asset classes more generally.
Warren, final question. We pose this as a hypothetical, not suggesting people go out and put their money into a single stock, but we do like to do this exercise. If markets were to close tomorrow for 5 years and you could only own shares in one company, which would it be? And I thought, just look back to that interview in 2022, you named Ferrovial as the infrastructure company that you would own. Since that time, share price is up 40% and it's paid €112 in distributions. Are you happy to continue owning Ferrovial over the next 5 years? Is that your stock?
Across the entire universe of opportunities, it would have to be one of my favorite ones still. I think in terms of balanced of probabilities, you know, National Grid would also be up there as a second name. But Ferrovial, even though it's done incredibly well, just how incredibly well those US managed lanes have done have just, and they're still relatively cheap. You're still talking about average tolls of $5, $3, $4. You're not talking about $15, $20 or something. And, you know, they're in congested corridors. The 407's recovering well. I think Ferrovial, if you had to close the world for 5 years and only own one name, it'll be that one because in 5 years' time, it would have paid you a massive dividend return. You're probably going to buy back more stock than it's already done. And in 5 years' time, you'll be even better positioned than you are today. If I had to throw a second one in the mix there, National Grid is also looking attractively priced for us. It's got really strong asset growth, probably 6-7% compound.
So just where is
National Grid? Sorry, my bad. National Grid owns the monopoly electricity transmission grid of the United Kingdom, and it also owns the gas transmission grid of the United Kingdom. It also has assets in North America, in the northeast of America. But it's essentially across all of its assets, it's looking at 7-8% rate base or asset growth per annum over the next 5 years. And on top of that, it will get guaranteed inflation protection through its revenue stream. So you're talking probably an equity growth rate of something like 14-15% per annum. And the risk around that growth rate is pretty low. So as far as low risk, high growth attractiveness, National Grid is right up there and Ferrovial will probably outperform my numbers even though they still look pretty punchy.
Warren, it's been great to have you back on The Rules of Investing. Thanks so much for taking the time to take our listeners on a deep dive in the world of infrastructure investing.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, James. Thanks for having me.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that chat with Warren. That is the end of the podcast. Remember, hit subscribe on your podcast players so you don't miss an episode.